Shall we call the next matter?
Okay, great. In re Vander Westhuizen, Fritz J. Furman, counsel for appellant Hilde Vander Westhuizen, Scott S. Weltman, counsel for appellee Anastasia Skye.
Okay, Mr. Furman, nice to see you again.
Good morning, Your Honor.
And how long would you like to reserve some time?
Yes, definitely. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes.
Okay. It's not every day we're talking about Ohio preclusion law.
That's correct,
yeah.
Your Honor.
It's, okay.
It's not. Fritz Furman appearing on behalf of the appellant. May it please the court. Your Honor, my client never got a full and fair opportunity to contest the issue of liability in the Ohio court. A default was taken quickly.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I was going to ask, okay, your argument that only damages were litigated.
That's correct.
How do you square that conclusion with the Ohio trial court, where at page 43 of its findings and conclusions, it states that notwithstanding the defendant's liability by virtue of her default, the court finds she made false and defamatory statements that injured Dr. Skye. And that notwithstanding language is done in two different paragraphs.
Your Honor, that doesn't square with the record in the sense that it's clear she never got to litigate that. In the damages portion, the court says we're only litigating damages
here. So we have the findings of fact and conclusions of the law,
yes,
where the trial court in Ohio says, says, I heard testimony from your client. We had a multi-day trial, and notwithstanding the default, I do find you liable. But then, you know, what evidence did you present to the trial court, the bankruptcy trial court, that showed that the Ohio trial court rendered its ruling that didn't allow her to speak? I mean, we have the trial court in Ohio saying, you did get to speak, you did get to call your witnesses, and notwithstanding the default, I find you liable, in essence. I'm paraphrasing. What did you show in response to the summary judgment motion that was wrong, or that your client didn't have the opportunity to speak on liability in Ohio?
My client's uncontroverted declaration that says unequivocally that she did not get a chance to defend herself on the merits as to liability. Frankly, I think the courts in Ohio's verbiage that notwithstanding, I think he had already decided based on the default that the facts were deemed admitted.
Okay. I understand that allegation, okay? But under Celotec, you know, on summary judgment, you've got to go beyond allegations. You have to show something in the record where the judge says no. We're not going to talk about this. And the record shows that he did allow her to call witnesses and do it and said, notwithstanding the default, I find this. I didn't see in the record any evidence. I see the allegations that your client said, no, it didn't happen. But doesn't Celotec require your client to say more?
As a general rule, probably, except that there wasn't more in this case, in that she was doomed once the default was taken. And in the I attached a copy of a portion of the transcript of the damages to my reply brief.
Yeah, well, okay, so we're looking at this de novo, at what was before the bankruptcy court. That sentence you put in your reply brief, you're going through a portion of the transcript which indicates that maybe she didn't get to do it. But that wasn't before the bankruptcy court. Why didn't you put that in the record in response to the summary judgment?
Your Honor, I was not aware of it at the time, and the underlying record is substantial, and I was not aware of it at the time. It's difficult to prove a negative, and I argued that to the court. It's difficult to prove a negative. What else can you say but I didn't do it? And over and over and over again, the damages portion
The question is really is whether it was actually and directly litigated, and the record of that is to show us what happened in Ohio. And you had the transcript that had the portion you put in the reply brief. That might have been really useful to the bankruptcy court. Maybe the judge would have come up with a different answer with that, but he didn't have that. And he did have the findings of fact and conclusions of law that has the notwithstanding, and this judge, was it six different days of hearings on this?
There were 5 to 6, it seems to me, partial days, but there were 5 to 6 at least partial days of testimony, mostly on Dr. Skye's behalf, fighting over the issue of damages, not liability, not wrongdoing, but damages. So she never really got a full or fair opportunity to litigate that issue of damages. And also, interestingly, the court in Ohio says notwithstanding, but relates to no evidence or testimony of liability. He relies, even though they use the word notwithstanding, it appears that they rely simply on what they deem to be admissions by the default. They say the facts are admitted by virtue of the default.
Let me drill down on that just a little bit, because I had the same fascination as Judge Corbett, and probably you, with all those findings and conclusions out of Ohio. And I think this is a situation where arguably defamation is a little bit different breed of cat, in the sense
pardon
that...
The pun.
Oh, yeah, excuse me. pardon me. In that there's some intertwining between the pieces that add up to liability. I think I'm going to agree with you that I'm still searching for where in the findings and conclusions other than the complaint slash default, there's a direct determination that your client made the statement. But there's an awful lot more to liability here. Was the statement made? Yes. Was it published? Yes. Was it false? Yes. Was it harmful in different ways? Yes. And defamation depends, you get to damages by assessing the kind of statement into whom it was made. So there's about 4/5 of the liability here that seems to me was intertwined in the damages piece. And when I looked over the findings and conclusions, there was testimony about every one of those other points. The one thing that was arguably a little bit obscure was, did she do it? And if that's what you mean by liability, I understand that. If you mean the broader question, I think I just read the findings differently than you do. So comment on that as much as you like.
Yes, Your Honor. If the other elements are there, but the question is, did she make the statement? Did she do it? If she did not, then the rest of it goes by the wayside and collapses completely. Also, it's even more critical in a 523A6 case, because you've got to make a finding that she willfully intended to harm the
plaintiff. And this is the funny case where that's not so hard. Somebody willfully intended it.
Yeah, except that it wasn't my client.
Well, yeah, but that's, again, for that to come up as it did in the bankruptcy court, I'm as curious as I think Judge Corbett is, as to what extent was that contested and what did you give the bankruptcy court to make an alternative finding? And I'm stuck there too, honestly.
It's a difficult thing, but again, Your Honor, when you didn't make a statement, what evidence do you show other than your testimony under penalty of perjury?
But the question here is not, in a sense, is not ultimately the truth whether she made the statement or not, but the issue before us is, did she actually and directly litigate the issue? And she says she didn't, and you've made that allegation, but then we have a record that shows that she did get to provide testimony, and notwithstanding the default, the judge found her to be liable.
However, the judge in that case doesn't elaborate as to what other evidence
right.
that they based that decision. It's almost superfluous, either that or he said there's so much else here, I'm going to add in that she must be responsible.
So what would have been really useful for the bankruptcy judge is to see the transcript that you quoted from in the reply brief, but not at summary judgment. And you know how to, you know the Celotex's burden of responding with facts. You know, how did you meet that burden if the evidence, the transcript, is first time before us in your reply appellate brief?
Other than the declaration, again in a negative, what do you say? But I didn't do it. I mean, how can you, you can't produce computer records that says, I didn't do it. And she has steadfastly fought and maintained that she has never did it. Also, as far as motive and willful intent to harm, her cat won. The cat's name is Leonardo, by the way, but her cat won. So what's the motive to trash this other person?
I'm waiting for someone to come up with a pun now.
Trash this other person mm-hmm. when your cat won.
Okay. You're at about 3:45.
Yes, Your Honor.
You want to pause
like
now?
To reserve,
okay. It's totally up to you, but if you want to pause now, that's great. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Counsel for the appellee, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. Scott Weltman, counsel for appellee Dr. Anastasia Sky. Greetings from Ohio, actually, so very relevant to my dual licenses in Ohio and in California.
Okay.
Speaking from experience, a 66-page findings of facts and conclusions of the law at a trial court in Ohio is rare. I didn't participate in the case below, but I will tell you that I've never seen a 66-page findings of facts and conclusion of law in Ohio trial court. That's how extensive the litigation was and how extensive the defense was to these allegations.
Well, counsel, let me just jump in and ask. We are much more familiar with dealing with California preclusion law for this court, and it recites usually the generally accepted, actually necessarily litigated. The Ohio standard is phrased differently, actually and directly. Does the actual and directly equate to necessary in the requirements or elements for issue preclusion under Ohio law?
You know, we cite the Ohio standard in our briefing. I mean, this was directly, Your Honor. This was.
But it wasn't necessary, was it? Because the default had been established for liability.
I understand what you're saying. And, you know, while there was a default standard finding of liability, what then occurred was a trial on the merits, and the language
on a called damage prove up.
Right. Actually, if I could follow up, Judge Breaker, you know, Mr. Weltman, how can we in our de novo review conclude that the defendant actually and directly litigated the issue of liability when on the first page of the Ohio trial court's findings and conclusions it stated that the matter before it was a damages hearings, and as such, liability is not at issue, and defendant has already been deemed liable. So we have that. We have the notwithstanding language that I quizzed opposing counsel about, but we also have this language. And if we're relying on the findings of fact and conclusions of law and what actually, whether it was at summary judgment level, whether it was actually and directly litigated, don't we have an issue of fact there based on just the face of this? Again, it says that we are here for a damages hearing, and as such, liability is not at issue. So doesn't that give some sort of inference to the debtor here that she didn't get to directly and actually litigate the liability?
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate the question. If that was the only sentence of the opinion, then I might agree with you.
Well, I'm not sure whether I'm raising a question. How I'm going to decide, I hope I haven't I haven't made that decision. Okay.
I'll rephrase it. If that was the only sentence, I might be concerned with that only sentence. But when I get into the additional 65 pages of an opinion, and I'm looking at part of the findings of fact conclusion of the law where the court multiple times said what the defendant did, which to make that statement, it didn't say because of the default, defendant did this.
It's interesting, though, to look at those voluminous paragraphs, and the citation that the judge used for most of those was the complaint. I didn't see in the air where the judge says, I've listened to the defendant and I believed her or I didn't believe her on this. I mean, it's not, he refers back to the complaint and not to trial testimony.
On the issue of did she do it, is that?
Right.
Yeah, on the issue of did she do it, I agree with that.
As to damages, well, it was pretty clear.
Well, as to was there a statement made, yes, there's testimony.
Right.
Okay, there were also exhibits to the complaint, right, for what that's worth.
Yeah, to the question of who made those statements.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and the court conclusively found, as did the Court of Appeals in Ohio, a three-judge panel, that this was the defendant who made those statements. And I'll admit, I don't remember the specific in the record. Originally, when the lawsuit was filed, Dr. Sky and their lawyer didn't know who made the statements. They needed to subpoena records to go behind the emails to find out who made those statements. And that's how they determined who the person was that made those statements. And so, you know, that embedded within the entire opinion is a conclusion that this person, if you think about it, this, how can you get punitive damages against a person who you by default decide that they made statements, right? The punitive damages part of it says that this person did it and did it with malice. It's embedded in the opinion, even in the Court of Appeals in Ohio, in the Fifth District, at paragraph 94, it says that, you know, the trial court heard testimony and was provided evidence which established appellant acted with malice in this case. It established that appellant, and that appellant being, well, appellant in both cases, our case and that case, specifically found that the appellant made the statements.
But again, you're starting from the premise that the appellant made the statements based upon the default judgment.
I'm not starting with that. I don't agree with that. That's...
Default judgment was entered. I mean, that obviously had legal effect, and that legal effect was to establish that defendant's liability.
Which then resulted in a six-day trial with
No, it could not have resulted in a six-day trial because liability was already established. The trial was on damages. It may have gone over, and that's the point I think Judge Corbett is saying. If you go over that, does that then establish liability as a matter of fact when it was not necessary because it had been established as a matter of law?
And I think to supplement what Judge Spraker is saying is that I'm looking at the punitive damages section, okay? And on page 54 of that document, two-thirds down the way of the page, this paragraph starts, defendant has already admitted by virtue of her default that defendant acted willfully and with actual malice. So again, we have as admitted by virtue of her default. I went through this and tried to find some place where the defendant admitted on at the evidentiary hearing, or I've listened to the debtor and I've looked at the evidence, and from her demeanor on the stand and what the language of these defaults, I conclude as a matter of fact that she made them. I didn't find that type of connection.
I understand your concern. However, it's built into the opinion. What's built into the opinion to have this level of detail, this level of damages, is that if the court, while the court may have granted a default, right, procedurally, ultimately, the level of detail that it goes through all the elements and it assesses damages after 6 days of hearings and 10 witnesses necessarily means that it was decided on the merits. There's no other conclusion that I can draw that says that this judge just flippantly said, well, it's a default. We're just going to have a hearing and we're just going to decide damages. That's it. The damages are built into the acts. It's all, and I hate to say bootstrapped, but it is ultimately bootstrapped by how it was decided.
Let me ask a slightly different subject, because I asked opposing counsel about this. Do you want to comment on the portion of the record that came in the reply brief?
What's contained with the record that this court is concerned with is the record that's in front of the bankruptcy judge when he made his opinion. And you cannot introduce new evidence into the record on appeal. You just can't do so.
I asked you that question because you didn't have a chance to reply to the reply. So,
right. No, okay.
That's why I'm giving you that opportunity.
Sure. And we've this case was litigated in Ohio not by me, but by other counsel. And again, so far there's five judges that have all agreed on the exact same facts, right? The trial court judge in Ohio, three appellate court judges, and now a bankruptcy judge. Right? We're asking for 6, 7, and 8 to agree with the same thing. I would also tell you that this case was vigorously defended, right? And I alluded to in the record below in the oral argument, on the schedules of listed creditors for the bankrupt debtor, for the appellant in this case, is her attorney, who's got a $66,000 unpaid bill. This was not a non-disputed, non-litigated issue, and there were some serious allegations that were proven. They were proven as far as what was done. You know, this appellant terrorized my client. This has been a horrible experience for her, right? This is, you know, these cap readers. It's clearly a very passionate situation. To the point where even my opposing counsel is still talking about who won the contest. Who still won the contest back in what year? And to be falsely accused of having dirty cat, you know, raising cats in a horrible environment, worse, to be a doctor and have someone go up anonymously, it turns out to be the appellant, the defendant in that case, and say that they lost their doctor's license. It's been a horrible experience, and it merited that many days of hearings. Like I said, the word default is a word that we're stuck with, but I think that's a sentence.
Well, it's let me jump in from a slightly different perspective. What is the font of the standard here? I mean, I think there were citations to a couple of Sixth Circuit BAP opinions. And it's an attempt by those courts to determine something that I think you might tell me is not necessarily finally determined for all purposes by the Ohio Supreme Court. So one way to look at those opinions is we really can't decide here. It wouldn't be our job to decide whether the Ohio courts got something right or wrong. They did what they did. The question is, was it complete enough? That's really the question, and that's the question I think we're all asking here. And one way to read the cases is to say that ordinarily in a default situation, it's very hard to tell that something was actually and directly decided, but you can look beyond that. So I think what we're struggling with here is how much do we look beyond the fact that it was a default? And it's not even so much what the judge said in a random statement of, well, the LIBOR is not an issue here anymore, because the question is, what did the judge do? I think is more to the point. And that's where I think that's where I'm struggling, because it's still hard for me to get over the line of to what extent was this basic question of it, was it her who did these things, is still murky for me. And that's obviously a big one.
Yeah, so I sort of heard two questions in there.
And, yeah, probably more than that, but go ahead.
that's okay. My clock is flashing at me here.
Yeah, okay.
So the identical parties litigated the identical issue that's at stake here in this case. That's the collateral estoppel part of it. These are the exact same parties with the exact same issues. And this was not this. I mean, I've personally taken hundreds, maybe more, default judgments in my day, which are done through motion practice and maybe through affidavits and maybe a brief damages hearing ex parte. When I say ex parte, the other party chose not to show up. Mm-hmm. But that is not this case. This is not a default hearing. This is not a default judgment award. Okay, and that's, you know, again, I would implore the court to really, I mean, I'm sure you have, but to reread the opinion and reread all the testimony and what took place. A judge, a trial court judge in any state, is not going to entertain 6 days of hearings when they've already made a decision that someone's winning and someone's losing. And that's not typical, and that's not, in this case, that's not what happened. What happened was a full trial on the merits. Not, again, the word notwithstanding is a critical word that's been pointed out. I was going to use it myself without trying to quote that case, but notwithstanding that, right? Notwithstanding that, you're talking about 6 days, 10 witnesses, where with an award of this level, this amount of damages, which is a significant amount of damages in a case like this, right? Where there were concrete, provable damages. No judge is going to make that ruling without having made that determination, which they put in their opinion, by the way, and which the Court of Appeals affirmed, by the way, that this was this defendant who took this action and who then had to have damages issued against them. Those are more than implied in both of those decisions. You know, my time is up, but I'm here to answer any more questions.
Anybody have a question?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Mr. Furman, you got about 3:42 here.
Yes, Your Honor. I'll try to be brief. When you start from the premise, which a default does, when you start from the premise that all the allegations in the complaint are conclusively established,
well, isn't it all the well-pleaded ones? I mean, I could file a complaint that says Northern Ireland belongs to the Republic, and so what, you know? Doesn't mean the Brits are going to give it back.
No, however, well-pleaded just means that you have factual detail.
But that's kind of, let me explore that for a minute. I'm not trying to interrupt you, but this is, there is a complaint. It does attach the emails. And at some point, there was some further research done, at least in the mind of the plaintiff here, that established that when you trace that back out, you get to the defendant. So there is something that's more than just someone said it. There is something that inferentially led to that. So does that, how do we factor that in?
Your Honor, they assume that all that is true, and they assume that my client sent those emails, notwithstanding that when they were purportedly sent, she was out of town.
Well, that's the great thing about the internet, right?
Well, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
That's the great thing about the internet. She could be out of town. She could be all kinds of places and send an email, right?
Yes. However, ordinarily, emails can be traced, and I believe in this case, the underlying case, they were in fact traced to at least her neighborhood in Minnesota at a time when she was not there.
Okay.
And I'm not asking this court to reverse the decision and render a judgment in favor of my client. I'm asking this court to reverse summary judgment and allow my client to put on a proper defense, at which time I'm confident that she will be found not liable. She didn't do it.
What would she put on that wasn't presented during those 5 or 6 days at the damages hearing?
Well, she wasn't allowed, and she didn't have the entire time. And as a sample,
that's the question. that you're saying she wasn't allowed.
Yes.
But what, all we know, I mean, in responding to this, we know that she was heard. We know that she could call witnesses. But nowhere do we have the transcript. You know, did the bankruptcy judge have a transcript that said, that the Ohio judge said, no, I won't hear you? Instead of that, the Ohio trial court judge says, okay, yes, you were defaulted, but notwithstanding, you know, after I heard you, I've concluded this. So at some point, we know she was heard. We know she spent attorney's fees in doing it. We know she called her witnesses. And notwithstanding the default, we know the judge found her liable. So where did the bankruptcy court judge have anything to support the fact that she wasn't heard?
Other than her declaration.
But all she said, I'm looking through, you can, if you want, I won't cut you off, even though it's only 15 seconds left, if you can tell me where. I've read her declaration. It talks more about service and jurisdiction and just has a conclusory thing, I didn't do it. Okay. The bankruptcy court heard that. The Ohio trial court heard her say that. What else was she precluded from presenting to the court, or either of the courts?
Essentially, she was prevented from offering expert testimony regarding the source of the email. She was prevented from saying she was in Denver with her family.
But that was not before, that was not argued to the bankruptcy court judge. That was not even, even
actually
alleged.
Her declaration, I believe, and I don't know the paragraph number, her declaration says, I was in Denver with my family. And so if the purported emails came from her house in Minnesota when she was in Denver with her family, which we could support with airline tickets and hotel reservations, she could...
But her declaration doesn't say that she was precluded from making that argument to the Ohio trial court.
They denied her motion to set aside the default, even though the default was taken within a couple of weeks of when the answer was due. They wouldn't let her... dispute the underlying facts, and those are critical, particularly to a finding of non-dischargeability, where those findings have to be narrowly construed in favor of the debtor. And in this case, the debtor did not have a fair opportunity to a full and fair opportunity to litigate. All the fight was over damages, which this was a complex area of law, both restraint of trade, unfair trade practices, slander, and the damages are fairly complex. So this, in my view, the largest time was spent simply on expert witnesses establishing that her practice was damaged, established that her reputation was damaged. And so my client didn't get to properly present a defense that she didn't do it. If this case is reversed, she will present such evidence, and I believe that the bankruptcy court would discharge this debt.
Okay. We're approaching 3 minutes over, so thank you so much.
I apologize.
No, don't apologize. It was very helpful.
Thank you.
Thanks to both of you for your very good arguments. We don't see this issue every day. We will do our best to get you something dispositive and quickly.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Okay. And with that, I think we are in recess.
All rise. This session is now adjourned.
Thank you.